Good morning. My name is Beverly, and I'm a very grateful recovering member of the Al-Anon Family Group.
Hi, Beverly.
And I was really glad he read that page. Frida and I read it together in the room this morning, and I just couldn't think of anything that would be more fitting to where I am. You know, I've had to accept reality. I've had to know that I've had some power, and the only way I could do that was through God. And, you know, denial was a tool that worked before, but it doesn't work anymore. You just got to face life head on. First of all, I would like to thank Dave and Marjorie for inviting me to be a part of your convention. And I'd like to thank Dave and Bill for coming to pick me up at the airport. John and I flew in together. And by the way, John, here's your newspaper. You left it here. We could tell he was a real alcoholic at the airport because he bought every newspaper that was available, and he read them all on the airplane. It was a 20-minute flight. So anyhow, John and I have had the opportunity to speak together a couple of times. So. And it's wonderful to see Vinoy again, and Don said that he has left his family, his puppy, to come to this flood-ravaged area to hear an Al-Anon speak. And they tell me that if an alcoholic's lips are moving, he's lying. But I'm glad you're here. And I've had a chance to see some old friends and some new friends, and I've had the opportunity to speak in Missouri a few times, and I really feel like when I got here, I felt like I was coming home. And I really want to thank you for loving me. I spoke in this very room a year ago, May, and that morning I asked you as I closed to pray for my son, and I want to thank all of you who did that for me. Because not only did you take on the responsibility of praying for my son and my family, some of you took the time to call us along the year. And I mean, the power of prayer is just unbelievable, because without your support and without your prayers, I know that my husband and I could not have walked the walk we've walked this year. I know that I have come through the most difficult thing I will ever, ever come through. And as I go on, I'll tell you more about that. I'm having a great time. I woke up this morning with a little rash all over, and my sponsor told me that only monkeys scratch, so I'm not going to stand up here and go like that. Anyhow, she called this morning, and we talked for a little bit, and a year ago today, she called me at 5 o'clock in the morning to announce that her husband had been accepted to have a lung transplant. And today is his one-year anniversary, and he's doing very well. And I can remember how emotional I felt, because, you know, the bind and the bonding that we have with people in this program just doesn't ever go away. It gets stronger as time goes on, whether we see people daily or whether we only see them once a year. Once we've made a connection with our souls and our hearts, it's forever. And I know that that day when she called and said that her husband was having a lung transplant, I know that I felt, you know, as much joy and as anybody could feel, and I was with her emotionally all day. And so anyhow, God has, you know, so many miracles in store for us. I came into the program in 1981, and I know that it has saved me. I came in the program as a result of putting our 15-and-a-half-year-old son into treatment, and they said to us that we had to attend meetings of Al-Anon because our son couldn't come home to an old idea, and I did that reluctantly, and it's just, I can't thank the program enough for what you've done for me. I was born in Chicago, Illinois, and we were in one of those little tight-knit neighborhoods where the houses were 3 feet apart, and as you got to be, I think the goal in life was to be tall enough finally that you could brace yourself against both walls and go up, you know, and about the time I got that big we moved, but at least I did it once. There was a lot of drinking in the family that I was raised in, and we celebrated holidays and Fridays and paydays, and when we celebrated those things, my mother was the one who would become out of control, and my father was the happy drunk. The thing that would happen in that is before my father would take a drink, my mother would get angry, and while my father was drinking, my mother would get angry, and after it was all over with, there would be anger then from both people. They would go for periods of time without speaking to each other after they would have one of these alcoholic fights, and the children, mostly myself, were used as the tools between that, you know, to go ask your father this and tell your mother that. And I know as a small child that was a very tense and uneasy thing for me to do, and I always felt better on the day when they would finally speak to each other. When I was 6 years old, a sister was born into the family, and when I was 9, my brother was born, so there are 3 children. My family is riddled with alcoholism, and the effects of alcoholism have been a part of my life since the day that I was born. However, it was not until I got into the Al-Anon program that I understood what the disease of alcoholism does to a family and what the disease of alcoholism does to us as people. And so I picked up all of these character defects and defense things from the family, reactions to life, and I went on like that until I got married. So I want you to first to understand that I know without a shadow of a doubt that my husband did not cause my character defects. He may have brought out some of them brighter, and he may have, you know, some of my better qualities may have gone by the wayside for a while. But today I know that he did not cause my problem, that I was already restless, irritable, and discontent long before I met him. I know that I had troublesome relationships when I was a child. It was always a matter of two's company and three's a crowd. I needed somebody's undivided attention. It was really important to me. And so what I would do if there was more than just me and another person who were together for that day, I would create a disagreement between the other two people so that that person and I could be just one-on-one. And I did that with all of my relationships. I know that I needed to be heard as a small child. And when you live in an alcoholic home, our motto in our house is that children were supposed to be seen and not heard. And so important things never mattered. And you lose kind of a degree of importance about your life when you would approach your mom or your dad and say, excitedly, wait until I tell you what happened today. And they would say, go away, I'm busy. I can't listen to you right now. Can't you see I'm peeling potatoes or I'm doing something? And you know, and I'd take that enthusiasm and it would be diminished. And then the next time I'd try to approach with that, it would be diminished. And finally, as time went on, I didn't think that I had anything important to share. I found a great deal of comfort as I grew older with my friends outside of the home. And I realized that not all homes felt like my home. That I could go to a friend's house and spend an afternoon with other people, and when I left, they would say, come back. And that invitation was never extended if I brought a child home. In fact, it was discouraged. It was just, you know, the house was kept neat and clean, and we were not allowed to bring children into our home. And then as I got a little bit older and understood that there were things going on in my house that weren't going on in other people's houses, it was by choice that I didn't bring kids home, because I started to take on the guilt and the feelings of shame about the things that were going on there. And I never knew what was going to set my mother off, what simple little mistake I would make or something that was not in order. And then she would start to scream at me in front of my friends, and I would feel this incredible feeling of disease and discomfort and embarrassment about that. So it got to a point where, without really consciously knowing it, I just didn't bring anybody home. It was just easier that way. My father's brother died of alcoholism. My brother is currently very, very ill with alcoholism. And my sister and her husband are in the fellowship in recovery. I have a sober son today and a sober husband today. And so, as you can see, there was a lot of alcoholism in my family. When I was about 9 years old, we moved from Chicago into the suburbs. And there I got involved with a group of friends, which were to be the people that I ran around with until we left when I was a senior in high school. By this time, I had made some decisions in my life. I knew that if I ever got married and if I ever had children, I would not scream at them. And when I ended up having to leave the suburban area and move to Utah when I was a senior in high school, I made another decision that if I ever got married and if I ever had children, I would never do that to them. That year that I moved from Illinois to Utah was an incredibly painful year for me. I didn't have the kind of emotional support that normal people had. You know, when you're going to do something as traumatic as move when you're a senior in high school, a normal family, I would suspect, would say, this is probably going to be a really lonely thing we're going to do. And for a period of time, you're going to feel like you don't fit in, and it's going to be really hard, but we'll do the best we can, you know, to do things as a family. Perhaps that's what a normal person would say. I'm thinking that they probably would, because those are the kinds of things that I'm able to share with my grandbaby today, that we know that things hurt. And So anyhow, I didn't have that kind of support, and when we got all moved and settled in, my mom and dad proceeded to have the absolute worst year of their marriage. They fought over things that my father denied and my mother was sure was reality, and they had terrible, terrible fights, and she ran away from home 3 times that year, and I was ended up, you know, being Susie Homemaker for this family, and I needed, you know, and I was dying inside myself because of just being there all by myself. I got to school and felt like I didn't fit in. My entire life was structured around American Bandstand, so now you know how old I am. And I came to Utah in that dress code, you know, the big bobby socks and the saddle shoes and a big felt skirt and a sweater button down the back and all that stuff. And I got where I was going only to find out that the Mormon girls dressed very, very, very different. They were, everything matched and they were very proper. So I didn't fit in. I mean, I just didn't fit in. So the only place I'd look around and find kids that looked like me was at the donut shop. And those kids were riding Harley Davidson motorcycles and they weren't the kind of person that I wanted to hang out with. So I didn't fit in the school. I didn't fit at home. I didn't fit in the donut shop. So I would check into school in the morning and turn right around and walk out the front door and for the next 6 hours walk up and down the streets of Ogden, Utah, and then get home in time together so that it looked like I'd been to school. The fact of the matter is that I slipped through the cracks and not even the school was aware that I wasn't there for quite some time. And when they finally approached my mom, she was so tied up with what she thought my father was doing, it was like, you know, I haven't got time to worry about this now. But even with kind of slacking off that year, I had enough credits to graduate, and after that I went back home and watched my friends graduate and came back, and my father got me a job at the defense plant where he worked. And it was the first time in a long time, possibly the first time, you know, that at least a year, that I felt like I belonged somewhere. I was working with people that were mostly old enough to be my mom, but they took real good care of me, and I needed some care then. And they would invite me to go to lunch with them, and they took a lot of time to show me how to do my job, and I felt very comfortable then. By that time, I had gained an excessive amount of weight, and I felt not only ugly on the inside, but ugly on the outside, and the fact is that these people were trying to show me that they loved me in spite of how I felt and what I looked like. I was working there a short period of time when our calculator broke, and the man that I am currently married to, and the only man I've been married to, will be celebrating our 32nd wedding anniversary this year, walked in to fix our calculator. And I just thought he was just wonderful from the first time I saw him, and to the very best of my ability from the, you know, place that I was coming from, I think I might have flirted with him. I'm not really sure. Maybe a little. I didn't know how to do that very well. And so he fixed the calculator and went about his business, and a little while, a couple of weeks later, some other piece of equipment in our area broke, and he came back again, and he asked me if I'd like to go out on a date. And I had not been officially asked out on a date. When you're in a place where I was, we did the youth center, and everybody was just kind of a group, you know. And so I don't know that before that I ever actually got asked out on a date. And he asked me out on a date, and I thought, well, a proper woman, you know, that's going out on a date would surely ask her mother and father if it was okay. So I made this guy go home with me and ask my mom and dad if he could take me out on a date. And you know, he did it. So he took me out on a nice date, and he bought me a steak, and he had a job. He was employed for 7 years. He had a convertible, and he smoked. That was really important. There was just a foxy way that he smoked, and he just got me then. There was a foxy way he drank too, which I didn't notice at the time. My mother hated him right off the bat. She had some intuitive thought that perhaps I was bringing home trouble. And my father loved him. He was a chip off the old block. He wanted a shooter and beer in the kitchen, and then they would come out and bring the girls a cocktail, and my dad just adored him. But we dated for about a year and a week, and finally got married. And the church that I had been a part of all of my life, I need to tell you about this. My mom and dad didn't go to church. When I was 5 years old, they turned me over to my aunt and said, raise her as a Catholic. So it was like, do as I say, but not as I do. So I was being raised as a Catholic and come home to a house that acknowledged no religion whatsoever. And I feel, as I look back over my spiritual path today, that it was really an absolute miracle, and that I knew perhaps not the spiritual, awesome, personal God that I know today, but I knew there was some comfort in going to church. And as a child, I went around with a lot of kids, and we went to all of the youth activities of all the churches, and I would go some Sundays to the Methodist Church and some Sundays to the Catholic Church. But the fact is that on my own, I got up every Sunday and I went to church until the day that I went to see the Monsignor and asked him if I could marry this man. And I knew that because he was a different religion than I was, that we could get married behind the altar. And we got that all settled up, and he, as a last thought, I said, and he's been married before, and they suggested that I discontinue the relationship and go and find myself a nice Catholic boy. And I think that's probably where my major resentment against not only religion but God came, because I didn't go to church again ever until, well, I went a little bit, but it never felt the same. I had this, so I guess I was angry and resentful at God. I guess you could call that a resentment. So George and I ended up getting married in the living room by a justice of the peace, and I guess it doesn't matter. It lasted 32 years, and that's all that really does count. We had a few close friends that my dad and I worked with come to the wedding, and we were off. So my mother told me on the day that I got married that she still wasn't real pleased about this, that, you know, he was a lot older than I was, and he had displayed some behavioral patterns that disturbed her. My father said, good work. But, you know, if I would have known anything about alcoholism, there would have been a part of me that would have thought, ooh, this looks like an alcoholic, but I didn't know that. I mean, I was born and raised in active alcoholism. It touched every fiber of my being, every cell in my body, and I had not a clue what it was. And I married it because it was the only thing I knew. I knew alcoholism. It was comfortable to me. I knew how to act with it. I knew how to react to it. And I married it because if you would have presented me with a man who says, I absolutely adore you, and he just was a nice chess-playing man, there would have been absolutely nothing about that that would have attracted me, and I know that today. I like the excitement and the energy and the not knowingness that an alcoholic can create in your life. I like to live on the edge. Still live on the edge today. we got married, and I didn't know anything about children, and 9 months and 2 days later I gave birth to a son. My husband and I got home from a day and a half of a honeymoon, and he went off to work and didn't come home for the next 22 years. And basically, that's a reality. He would leave for work about 5 o'clock in the morning and not show back up again till 8, 9, 10 o'clock at night. So basically, I did all of that on my own. And of course, I did a wonderful job of it. You know. Shortly after I got into Al-Anon, they removed one of those cysts off my hand, and they say that's an Al-Anon cyst from going like this. So I have a scar to prove that I'm a real martyr. Yeah, and I took my job well. I took on all the responsibilities of martyr and restless, irritable, and discontent, and I did everything to my children that I promised I would never do, because it's all that I knew. Today, there's a lady that attends my home group, and she was the first person I heard say this, and I know that it has been said over and over again, that we did the very best we could with the light we had to see by. And I had a dim light, and I did the best that I could do. The fact is that I didn't do a very good job. But also, when I got into Al-Anon, there was a sign on the back of the podium pasted right over there, and it says that I didn't cause it, I couldn't control it, and I couldn't cure it. And I felt some sense of relief over that, because by the time we were in the program for 6 weeks, my two sons and my husband were carrying chips in their pocket for sobriety. So either I could take on the responsibility for causing all of that alcoholism, or I could really come to believe in that sign that I had nothing to do with that, and that my recovery was my responsibility, and whatever happened to them happens, and it had nothing to do with me. And as time's gone on, I've been able to accept that and to work with it and to know that none of it was my fault. I reacted to it, I responded to it, but I didn't create it or cause it. So I am now left raising this baby, and I had these feelings like there's something wrong with me. Otherwise, this man would come home. I had lost weight by then, so when I looked in the mirror, you know, I thought I looked okay. And I did changed my hair to a different color. I identified with Nancy. And I changed my hair, and I thought that, you know, I was a good cook. I kept a nice, clean house, and I couldn't figure out what was wrong with me that he wouldn't come home. You know, I thought, well, maybe if I was a little bit thinner, maybe if I learned how to cook a little bit better, maybe if I started to mow the lawn or change the oil in the car, you know, then he would come home. But he didn't come home for a long time. That, not the alcoholism, was what I thought was the cause of my problem, was the fact that I was left in this marriage to just be by myself. So what happened is that I became restless, irritable, and discontent with these children, and they became as I became, they never knew what was going to set me off. They never knew if they could comfortably bring a child into the home to play for a few minutes, or if I was going to scream and yell and embarrass them. And one of the days that this happened, you know, I could go on and tell you a lot of things about who I was, but I think you already know that I belong here and that I've been deeply affected by the disease of alcoholism, and I was one of the people that they talk about in this program that probably comes to the program much sicker than the alcoholic. At first that offended me, but today I know that's the truth. And if you're sitting in the audience today and somebody has said that to you, please don't be offended. You just need to jump into the steps and get busy working. One day the boys had come down into the rec room. They brought a game, Monopoly game, set it out on the picnic table, and brought some kids in, started to play the game. I brought down some cookies and a pitcher of Kool-Aid, and they were busily, you know, having a great time. And I got upstairs and I noticed something out of order. And you know, you never know what it's going to take. It can be any little thing. And when you're upset and you don't know what the source of that pain is, you will look at some little thing that's out of order, like perhaps a child that forgot to take out the garbage, and you will do what I did, maybe. Maybe you reacted to that a different way. But I stormed down those basement stairs, and I threw open the door, and I started to scream about whatever it was that was out of order. And it wasn't but a few minutes. The game was folded up. The kids had all scattered and gone where they belonged. And one of my boys, I don't know which one it was, came upstairs and looked at me. And you know, I can hear the pain in that child's voice, but I can't see the picture. I don't know which boy it was, but I can still feel the pain of that moment. And he looked at me, and he said, "Mom, why do you always have to embarrass us in front of our friends?" And I didn't have a clue why I had to act like that in front of those kids. I didn't know have a clue what was causing me to be like that. My whole vision is I love my home. I'm one of those people they call a nester. My home is real important to me, and it's always been important to me. And I tried to create a comfortable environment in that home, but I didn't have the tools. You know, I had some decorating skills, but I didn't have the skills from inside to create the kind of environment that I wanted in that home. I did provide them with clean clothes and good food, and, you know, I baked cookies. And I tried to do on the outward part of me some of the things that I thought a good mother would do. But the thing is that they could have done without all that stuff if I could have been there for them and looked in their eyes when they told me a story about their life. And see, I didn't know how to do that because I never had anybody to do that for me. And so that was the way that it was. By the time the boys got to be 11 and 13 years old, I know today because they've shared it with me, they were already experimenting with drugs and alcohol. And shortly after that began to happen, we moved from New Jersey, which is where we were living at the time, to Texas. Stephen at that time was 16 years old. He was involved heavily with wrestling. And in Texas, football is the number one thing to do. I mean, people are just really high on football in Texas. Well, in New Jersey, people were high on wrestling. And Stephen had potential to become a state champion in the field of wrestling. And he was being groomed for that with the wrestling coach. And he had been to a lot of tournaments, and he'd done well. And we supported that. I know that, you know, I when I look back, I know that I sat on those bleachers until I thought I had calluses. So I did the very best I could do. And he had great potential in the field of wrestling. And off-season, he was a cross-country runner and a backstroker on our little local swim team. And he was real involved in athletics, and he was very good at it. Scott tried some of those things, too. He was not as good as his brother at that. But they were both real active and real involved in sports. So my idea was I says, Dad's got a promotion and we've got an opportunity to leave New Jersey and go to Texas, and we're going to do that. I want the raise. I want Dad to have the new job, and we're not going to worry about you guys because you're wrestlers and you swim and you run cross country. You just go to the new school, put your name on a couple of things, say I'm going to join, and before long you'll have all the friends that you need. And that's the way that I presented that to them. Stephen was to approach. He was approaching his junior year in college, in high school. He was going to be the captain of the cross country team the next year, and he's a very quiet, inward child. And I did not have a clue what an honor that was for him, what an esteem building thing it was for him to be made the captain of his cross country team. And I said, it's not a big deal. We're just going to move. Dad's going to get a promotion. We're going to have a new house, and we're going to live happily ever after. So we got to Texas, and Steve got a pickup truck, and a lot of times there would be a lot of beer cans in the back of the pickup truck, and when I would ask why all those cans were in the back of the truck, they always had an answer to that. He'd say, well, you know, last night, Mom, was Tuesday, and we went to the drive-in, and he says, you know, everybody drinks a couple of beers, and dumpster's way out on the corner of the lot, so, you know, I just said to everybody, throw the cans in my truck, and I'll take care of them at the grocery store. We'll just dump them in the dumpster at the grocery store. Stephen was not only a sports enthusiast, he was also an A student, and he had a part-time job, and he was a winner. I mean, what else would you want from one of your children? But what I wasn't looking at was his eyes, and by the time we got to our first AA meeting with him, the lady that looked at him when I first walked in the door said to me, Beverly, do you have any idea this child is half dead? And you know, I didn't know that, but I look back at pictures now of our family, and I can see. I can see. But I was in such denial about what was happening to my family and the deterioration of what was going on that all I could see was two happy, joyous, and free children and a nice, clean house and a happy mom and a father that was never there, which is gives you good reason to be angry. So about this time, they came home with a little package of seeds, and I was really excited about helping them along in making friends and to do whatever I could to create a happy environment for them. And they came back with this little package of seeds, and they said to me, Mom, we have a science project. And I said, great, what do we have to do? And they said, well, we have to grow our seeds and take notes, and at the end of a six-week period, we have to go back to our science teacher and report the progress of our experiment and find and identify our plants. And so I went out in the garage. I had flower pots. I love plants, so I had lots of flower pots out there. I went down the nursery and got us a great bag of very good potting soil. I prepared 10 plants, put them in southern exposure in my bedroom window, and we got our experiment going. And you know, it wasn't but a few days. I mean, with getting such good care and light and food and sunshine, it was only a few days before the plants were up, and a couple more days, you know, they were up about this high, and I'd come home for lunch and they'd be leaning, and I would turn all of our pots, and I would, you know, one day I looked and they had pointed leaves, and I said to the kids, you know, I think we've got marigolds. And I said, but it looks like they're all going to be marigolds. There's no variation in this. They all are marigolds. And we were developing a neighborhood interest by now. And, you know, I thought to myself, that's really great. Our science project is coming along really good, and a lot of kids are taking interest in coming to look at our plants. And they just parade through the house and look at the plants and, you know, pat Scott and Steve on the back and... Right, you know, and go out the door, and, you know, and I was doing things like saying, are we taking notes, are we, you know, I'm turning them, do we need to fertilize, what do we need, you know, I really wanted us to have a successful project. And then all of a sudden one day, you know, they got real, like about this tall, and the leaves were big, and I said, you know what, I think we have hybrid marigolds. These are just not ordinary marigolds, these are hybrid marigolds. And time went on, and I nurtured them and watered them, and the interest grew in the neighborhood, and more kids were coming to see our project, and I mean, I was taking a lot of pride in this, because I thought, God, these kids have made a place for themselves, and it hasn't been all that long, and they're not like me, they're not feeling lonely or, you know, without friends. I mean, they have really made it, and everything's going to be okay. And so I came home from work one Friday, night, and I worked at a bank, so I got in quite late. And by the time I got there, there was nobody at home. George had not arrived, and the kids had long since gone. And I went into my bedroom to change my clothes, and I looked at our plants, and the pots and the dirt were there, and the plants were gone. And I just got so upset. I thought, my God, what am I going to do? I'll call the science teacher. Oh, it's 7 o'clock Friday night. Who is the science teacher? I never thought to ask any questions, and I didn't know who the science teacher was, and I was just in this tizzy. They're going to fail. The teacher will never believe we really did it. I know I can take the empty pots to school and say, look, we really did have plants in there. I mean, all this stuff is just going and going and going. I mean, you know how we are. We can just get it going, and I got it going, and I changed my clothes, and I thought, well, it was one of the first times before program that, you know, it said do the next best thing. So it was do put the laundry away. So I did that. And when I went into Scott's closet and turned on the light and I turned around to hang something up, there thumbtacked on the inside of the closet wall was our science project. And I stood there for a moment in total disbelief. It's like, is deja vu the right word? Or I mean, just that, like, what is this? I mean, you go into this place where you don't know what it is for a couple of seconds until reality hit me, and I realized, you know, those are our plants, and the cats didn't eat them, and why does he have them stapled on the wall? And then I thought, my God, I am growing marijuana in my house. And you know what happened to me? I felt guilty. I felt embarrassed because for all of these weeks I'd been with these kids making a fool out of myself. And I knew every time they got out in the driveway they'd say, you still got her, Scott. You know, I knew that's what they were saying to me. And I got this feeling like if I could get my hands around one of their necks, I'd kill them. And then if I could get my hands around George's neck, I'd kill him. But then the cat and the dog left, so, you know, and I was there by myself. And all of these feelings of anger and that yucky feeling of being ashamed of my behavior and my stupidity and all of that stuff being, you know, taken in, all hit, and it was just one of those days. And, you know, I realized today that I had a lot of those days, but that day, it was like a neon. When the kids came home, we found out that we were not only growing it in our windowsill, they were growing it all over the place. By that time, little tools were hanging on their driving shaft of the steering column, and pieces off of golf clubs and ceiling fans were missing. And then I started to notice that pieces of things that were my belongings were missing. And when I would approach the boys about what had happened to something like they had a little brass pitcher on our bookshelf, and I said, where did that go? And Stephen says, oh, I don't know, Mom. And then he'd say, Scott, Mom wants to know about a brass pitcher on the shelf. Do you know anything about that? And Scott would go, no, Mom, we never had a brass pitcher. And I'd say, but I think we did. Well, maybe we didn't. And then what else would start to happen is when I would question these things, you know, what about this pair of earrings I can't find? What about this ring that I can't find? Nobody ever knew what happened to anything. So I would come home for lunch, and now what's happening to me is that I'm making a joke at work about what's happening in my house because I didn't know how else to handle it. It was getting bizarre. And I would make jokes about it at work, and I would start home after, or go back to work after having my lunch, and I couldn't remember if I locked the door, and I'd turn around and come back, check the door, then I'd get back down the road. I couldn't remember if I let the dog in. I couldn't remember if the back gate was locked. Did I shut the freezer door? Did I turn off the stove? I mean, my life was just totally out of control, and I couldn't remember things. And the more things that turned up missing, and the more questions I asked, the more bizarre answers I got, and they were in total agreement with each other, so I thought I was the one who was going crazy. And life went on like that. And there was one night that both of my boys almost got killed. Stephen, his girlfriend out for a year or so, by that time, a year I guess, broke up with him just before graduation. He was devastated and turned to two bottles of Mad Dog 2020. And he always had a little angel named Kelly, and I mention her today because she always made sure Steve got home. She had an alcoholic father, and she knew how to take care of that. And she would make sure Steve and the pickup got home, and she'd park the pickup, throw Steve in the front door. And she had always made arrangements to have somebody follow her to take her back. And I know today to be very, very appreciative for Kelly because she was his angel. So that particular day, Kelly put Steve in the front door. And I went about my business, and all of a sudden I realized Steve's laying flat on the floor. And I asked what was going on with him, and he says nothing. I mean, he could barely talk. So I call, up here says he's drunk. Down here says, you need to call an ambulance. He's really in trouble. He's real sick. Up here says, If you call an ambulance, what would those people think? If you said, my son is drunk and he needs help, they're going to think you're not a good mother and you can't take that risk. So I didn't call an ambulance. Instead, I called my sister and I said, Stephen is very, very drunk and it seems to me he's not breathing right. And she says, oh, just put him in the bathtub. Now he's 6 feet, 2 inches tall and weighs 180 pounds. And my sister says, put him in the bathtub and throw cold water on him. And every time you do that, he's going to go, oh, and she says, just do that until you feel like he's breathing okay. A couple of years ago on a trip to Florida, my husband and I were listening to a talk radio show and realized after we finished listening to whoever was on the radio that that could have been alcohol poisoning and my son could have died that day. I called my husband and said, you've got to get him out of the bathtub because now I've wet the Levi's and now he weighs 200 pounds. And I couldn't. I mean, as much as I tried, I mean, I really tried to get that boy back out of the bathtub and I couldn't get him out of there. And so George came home and got Stephen out of the bathtub, dried him off, put him to bed, and he fixed me a cocktail because he knew I'd had a rough night. And a couple of seconds after that, the telephone rang and it was Scott. And he said to George, we're okay, but the car's totaled. Eric and I weren't really paying attention to the back road on the way to Young Life, and we hit a sharp curve, and the car went off and down a ditch and through a fence and hit a tree. But what happened, Dad, is that the car's old and the seats fell backwards, and Eric and I ended up laying flat as the post from the fence came through the windshield. And my husband came home after he went to see that car, and he said to me, I don't know how those boys survived. If they hadn't have gone backwards, they would have both been dead tonight. I was to later find out that they were smoking marijuana. They had picked up a dead skunk on the road, tied a rope around its neck. Scott, who didn't even have a driver's license, was driving this little Toyota Celica, and Eric was hanging out the other window, pulling this skunk along the road, and the faster they went, the funnier it appeared when you're stoned. Slightly out of denial about what might be the problem, when a friend of mine at work told me about her son who was in intensive care after an accidental drug overdose and was now in a place called Westgate in Denton for treatment for alcoholism and drug addiction. And as she started to tell me how it was that her son got to that place, there was a little part of me inside of here that was saying, that's the kind of stuff that's going on in my house. So we took Scott down there for evaluation, and little alcoholics are just as cunning, baffling, and powerful as big alcoholics. And he was able to kind of con this counselor, this director of this treatment facility, into believing that he may not have a problem. But the guy came out to us, and he said, you know, he's 15 and a half years old, and you tell us about some of the things that he's doing, and he's told us some things, and he said, if it's all really kind of true, you're going to know in a short period of time whether he is or isn't an alcoholic, and when you're ready, just bring him back. And it was about 2 weeks after that. It was February 9th of 1981. It was a Monday, and it was raining. And I can remember that day as if it happened yesterday. And I missed another piece of jewelry, and I confronted Scott about it that day, and he said to me, Mom, I sold it to one of those gold dealers, and you know I can't get that back. And I went into some kind of a rage about, I don't care how you have to do it. I don't care if he has to reconstruct the gold. I want it back. And he's standing there telling me, I can't do that, Mom. It's gone. You know, I did that on Friday, and I've already spent the money, smoked it away, whatever. It's gone, Mom. And I called in sick to work that day. And I didn't really realize how sick I really was that day, but I called in sick. And a few minutes later, Scott called home and he says, Mom, if you'll come and get me at school and take me to that place, I'll go in for treatment for drug addiction and alcoholism. So I went to the school and I picked him up and I went into the principal's office and I said, I'm going to take my son out of school for 28 days so we can put him in for rehab for drug addiction. And at that time, and I know that it's changed today, but at that time he said to me, that's good. We don't need a drug addict in our school system. And I got out of there thinking that I had, you know, something really dirty, that I had something to be ashamed of. So I got there and the counselor, who was just under 5 feet tall and didn't even weigh 100 pounds, put her finger in my nose and said, you have to go to Al-Anon or you can't come here and visit this kid. And I said to her, do you have any idea how busy I am? And she said, no, how busy are you? And I said, I work. And I'm not one of those kind of people that just throw a TV dinner in the oven. I says, I cook and clean and everything. She says, well, set your vacuum cleaner aside for a few minutes and you've got to go to an Al-Anon meeting. And I had been a long time since I cared anything about that kid. I had stopped touching him. I'd stopped telling him I loved him years before February of 1981. And fortunately, she knew that. And as I was going to Al-Anon, she said to me, you know, Beverly, you might find a lot of comfort if you could go up to these boys and put your arm around them and say, has anybody told you I love you today? And the first time that I did that for Scott, I hated it. I didn't want to touch him. He didn't smell good. I was resentful about all of the things that he had taken from me. I was resentful about the holes that he'd kicked in the wall and the doors that he'd damaged and the doors he'd left unlocked and the times that my dog was left abused out in the backyard. And every time I would touch those kids, all I could feel was that all of that resentment and those feelings, those negative feelings against that child. But this lady said to me, you've got to do that. If you don't do it for him, you've got to do it for yourself. And I would with so much resistance, I would put my arms around him and I'd say, Scott, has anybody told you they love you today? And there was a healing in that. Because what happened is it was catchy. And the next thing I knew, I was able to put my arms around Stephen and say, has anybody told you they love you today? And then the next thing I realized that George and I were doing it. And we were saying, has anybody told you they love you today? And we were starting to mean it. And all of a sudden, when I would put my arms around Scott and ask him if anybody had told him I loved him today, I could smell him. And I could feel some of the resentments going away. And I would look at him and I'd think to myself, he's really handsome. And I had seen all of those things about him. I was so wrapped up and so sick in my own disease, I couldn't see what beautiful children I had. So I did go to Al-Anon, and I went there reluctantly. And on the first day, I thought maybe if I just sat out in the hallway, nobody would know. I mean, I could say I went, but then I realized I'm chasing the treatment center bus, and surely somebody would go back and say, you know, Beverly's sitting out in the hall. She didn't really go to Al-Anon. And so it was only a matter of a meeting or two before I started to feel that I belonged. The first time I saw the steps on the wall, I took out a piece of paper and a pencil and I wrote them down. I knew intuitively that there was something powerful in those, and I thought, well, maybe they've got these 12 instructions here at the treatment center, but maybe I'll never see them again. And the first time I saw the steps, I wrote them down. So the miracle of recovery happened to me. I went to a home group that read the steps and read the traditions, much like we did today. They had this sign on the podium that says I didn't cause it, and they said to me, keep coming back. So people started to invite us to go out for ice cream, and we started for the first time as a family to begin to feel a part of. And on on February 23rd, my husband and I were coming back from the treatment center, and he said after reading a couple of paragraphs in the big book, he knew that he was an alcoholic, and that tomorrow night at the open AA meeting that he was going to get a desire chip. And I said to him, you have got to be kidding. And sure enough, he went up and got a desire chip. Now, he continued to go to Al-Anon for a few more weeks after he got his AA desire chip, and I finally found it necessary to kick him out of my meeting. And he listened. He minded. On March 29th, which was a Sunday, Stephen came home from his job. He was a night stalker at a grocery store, and he came home from his job noticeably drunk. And I looked at him, and I said, my God, Steve, you're drunk. And he said, yeah, they don't talk. And then Scott said for him, he says, God, Mom, Steve's worse than me. And that day, we went on to the meeting, and I started to believe in what you were telling me about trusting people here, about you only sharing your experience, strength, and hope, and that if you didn't know the answer to my question, or if you had not actually gone through the problem yourself, that you would say, I don't know anything about that. You'll have to talk to so-and-so. And even though it had only been a few weeks, the trust level I was beginning to feel within the walls of Al-Anon and Alcoholics Anonymous was beginning to develop. And that morning when Stephen came home drunk, we went to the meeting and I asked a man there that had several children in and out and up and down from alcoholism, graduating from college, in jail, out of jail, you know how it all happens. They had a his and hers family of six boys, and I thought I had it bad. And I said, you know, I think Steve might have a problem with alcohol as well. And he said to me, you have two choices. You can go home and suggest to him that he join you in the road of recovery, or you can ask him to leave. He has a job. He's 18, almost 18 years old. He's about to graduate from high school, he did graduate from high school. It was the year after. And he says he is certainly able to live on his own. You have a family that's trying to experience sobriety and serenity, and you cannot have somebody who's actively peddling drugs out the front door living at your house. And after Steve woke up that day, my husband and I said to him that he had two choices, that he could either join us on the road to recovery or he had to leave the house. And you know, when you begin to confront this disease and you start to tell the alcoholic some of the ways that you feel, and you start to set up some rules for the first time, you make them real mad. And I'm afraid of angry people. I because of the anger and the violence that I lived in my home, there's still a part of me that hasn't healed from that. So I become like Nancy talked about last night, you know, saying yes to things that I don't want to say yes to just because it's easier than saying no and have to deal with the consequences. But somewhere or other, I had the courage to tell Stephen that if he didn't join us in recovery, he had to leave. And of course, he got angry. I mean, how else could he respond to that? So he gets in his pickup and he gets out of the driveway backwards at 80 miles an hour. And, you know, I thought to myself, I'll never see him again. I've really hurt him. And about 20 minutes later, he called me from the grocery store. And Stephen has the first dime he ever made. So paying rent would have been a big step. So he wanted to, of course, try Alcoholics Anonymous one time rather than leave the house. And I suggested to him that it would have to be a lifetime recovery one day at a time, and that he couldn't just come with us on Monday night and call it quits. He would not be recovered. So that was the night I walked in the door. Getting there was an interesting thing. It talks, I can tell you about a little more family disease. We're sitting in a little Mustang, two boys over 6 feet tall. George's driving, and I'm in the passenger seat, and George caught a glimpse of Stephen in the rearview mirror, and he's wearing a Coors hat and a tequila t-shirt, titty shoes, holy jeans, and an earring, which drove George crazy. That's why he drank. That earring was why he drank. So he catches a glimpse of his son in the rearview mirror, and he says, I cannot take a son of mine to Alcoholics Anonymous dressed like that. And Scott says, who's practically dressed the same way except George couldn't see him in the mirror, he says, you know, it doesn't matter what you wear to AA, Dad. All that matters is if you get sober. And George couldn't hear that, and the fight went on, and all of a sudden George jumped out of the car, and he's starting to walk home, and my first thought was, I have to go there because we still have a little liquor in that liquor cabinet, and I need to go save him, and Steve can drive the car, and I'll go chase George. And then all of a sudden I had probably my first moment of clarity, and it said, drive the car. So I got out, and I walked around, and I drove the car, and that was the night when we walked in. Millie said to me, Stephen looks half dead. She also suggested to Bobby that he talk to Stephen after the meeting, and Bobby said, I am not getting involved with any more young people. You work with them 2 or 3 weeks, you stay up all night, you get them through all their stuff, and then they get drunk. It's not worth it. Now, I don't know what kind of magical powers Millie had over Bobby, but when I got out of my Al-Anon room, I went into the hallway, and I saw Bobby and Stephen in a little room off to the side, and I remembered thinking to myself, what a nice thing that man was doing for my son. What I actually got to witness for the next 6 weeks, which was probably the chains that really bind me to my recovery program, is the beauty of watching one drunk working one-on-one with another. And I got to see what was happening to Stephen when he was getting good orderly direction that was coming out of the big book. And Bobby was calling him in the morning to make sure he got home from work okay, because the kids did dope in the parking lot during their lunch hour, so it was a hard place for Steve to go. And so Bobby would call and check to make sure Steve got home. And then at night, Bobby set his alarm clock for 1 o'clock in the morning, and he would take his big book and go to the grocery store and sit with Stephen during their lunch break, and they would talk about recovery so that Steve could go back to work and not be tempted to go out into the parking lot, because Bobby understood how vulnerable Stephen was to those drugs right now, and he stayed with him. And then at night, Bobby, before Stephen went to work, Bobby would remind Steve to pray. And through my bedroom wall, I could hear my son praying to the God that Bobby was introducing him to, and asking him for this day of sobriety, and at night thanking him for the day of sobriety. And yet I knew on myself that I couldn't pray on my knees. And it was a long time in recovery, many, many years in recovery, until praying on my knees became a part of my daily routine. I just felt like, you know, if anybody saw me, they would laugh. But about 3 or 4 years ago, I spent a weekend with the lady that's my sponsor. And, you know, I'd be talking to her, and all of a sudden I'd look, and by God, she's down on her knees praying. She's not paying any attention to me. And I watched that for a whole weekend. Friday night she prayed, Saturday morning she prayed, Saturday night she prayed, Sunday morning she prayed. She didn't care what I had to say. She was praying. And I made a commitment to her and to myself, because recovery is a full circle. And our prayers ask us to turn our will and our life over to the care of God. And in the 11th step, you know, it says, sought through prayer and meditation. And to acknowledge God's will for us. And the only way that I realized that I could do that successfully was not driving in my car. It would be to actually physically kneel on my knees and pray. I'm not saying that I didn't do it when I got my tail in a crack. We always do that. You know, we'll get down and pray for a couple of days because times are really getting tough. But most of the time, you know, we get so busy and think, oh, well, God knows where I am. But I've made this conscious decision to do that for the past 3 or 4 years, and it has made a complete circle of my recovery, and I feel whole now. So recovery went on in our house, and we felt that incredible pink cloud, and everybody was sober, and we were getting invited to follow people and have ice cream, and they thought we were precious, and my boys were, you know, active, and I could start to see how beautiful they were. And shortly after that, Scott got drunk. And I used to sit in a meeting and think that drunkenness only happened to that lady because she wasn't working a good program. And I had this smug attitude about people who had a slip in this program. And when it happened to me, I had to get a big book of my very own, and I had to come to a level of understanding of alcoholism, the disease, that I could have never come to had Scott not lost his sobriety. I think I would have always, I feel like I would have talked the talk, but truly not been able to walk the walk if Scott had not lost his sobriety at that time. And I sunk my teeth into that big book and I read it because it answered a lot of my questions. It told me that he lied when the truth would serve him different. It told me that once he took a drink that he had no control over what he drank or smoked or put in his arm next. And it told me a lot of things. When Scott would call, finally we asked him to leave, and then he came back and he went to treatment the second time, and he came back, and a few months later he lost his sobriety again. And Bobby had started to convince me that my home was a privilege, and I started to believe that my home was a privilege and that the people who lived there had to treat it with respect. And Scott had gotten back into a stage of alcoholism and drug addiction where he was unable to treat my home with respect. And I was starting to gain enough dignity that I knew that that's what we required in that home. And so when Scott was 16 and a half or 17 years old, it was Valentine's Day. I asked him to leave my home, and he never lived with us again. Shortly after that, he got married. Somebody else, you know, she needed an alcoholic to take care of, and I mean, she got her a good one. We made some decisions during that time that sometimes I share them and sometimes I don't. But you know, Scott had turned 17 years old and he's trying to work. He dropped out of school completely by that time, and he needed a car. So I worked in a bank, and a loan was an easy deal, so I signed a loan, and we got him a little car. And within 2 weeks, he got a speeding ticket for driving 80 miles an hour in a residential area that was posted for 25 or 20. And he also was stashing marijuana in the roof of the car and had fixed a way where he could sew it back up again and you wouldn't see it. He was carrying big amounts of liquor in the trunk, and George and I invited that because we had the responsibility to do that because our name was a co-signer on that loan. And we took the car away from him because you told me I could do that. You were telling me about loving an alcoholic but not having to enable them. And there's a lot of difference, you know, between this kind of love. It's good love. It's unconditional love. And I took the car away because I loved Scott. And the only thing that I could think of is that I didn't want to be responsible for that car. I knew that Scott was an alcoholic and possibly someday he might die of his alcoholism. But I also knew that if in that process he killed somebody else's child and my name was on the line, that I couldn't handle that. And so we took the car away, we had it cleaned up, we sold it, and that was the end of it. And I never, and you know, that for that I got a lot of phone calls. You love Steve better, you don't like me, I'm living in the streets, I sleep with cockroaches in places where the doors don't lock, Mom. Steve's going to reapply for Texas A&M University. He's got that cute little Tonka pickup with the big wheels and all the lights, and you know, he's clean and his hair's cut. And he's sober, and his sponsor told him he should go for college, and he says, I'm afraid of freshman English. And Bobby encouraged Stephen to take freshman English in a little junior college where it wouldn't feel overwhelming. And from that place, he got an A+, and it was all that his self-esteem needed. And he sailed on through 2 years of college in the little junior college and then reapplied at Texas A&M and was accepted there. And 5 semesters later, my husband and I had the privilege of watching that boy walk across the stage, and he graduated from college, and it was almost impossible to get from that boy that was in the back seat of that car that night that we were going to our first AA meeting to the young man who had graduated from Texas A&M University. And he had a job with a major clothing company by that time, and he went down to Houston to work. And I got my first experience with that horrible, horrible empty nest syndrome, and it's real, and it needs a lot of nurturing, because when they all go, and Scott had left, but God let me keep Stephen a few extra years. So God really has been graceful and gracious and kind to me, and I've had to look for the miracles. And Stephen is a miracle. He celebrated his 12th year of sobriety on March 30th of this year, and I'm really grateful for that. So anyhow, Scott and Doreen got married, and George and I are real involved in the program, and life is getting good, and I'm learning how to respond to an active alcoholic. And Scott and Doreen ended up moving down to Florida, and shortly after they got down there, they were married a couple of years, and Doreen had the idea that if they had a baby, Scott would get better. And so she got pregnant. And, there was a part of me that thought, oh, my God, one more child born to active alcoholism. But the God of my understanding was so good to me that he took Scott and Doreen and he moved them to Orlando, Florida, and finally down to Fort Lauderdale during the last 2 years of his really, really bad drug abuse and alcoholism. And I always knew that was God's gift to me, that he knew that I couldn't watch what was going to happen in the next 2 years. So they went down to Florida, and the baby was born, and I got to go and spend a week with Doreen after the baby was born. And when I left that child, I had to do with her what I had learned to do with Scott, and that was to put my hands like this and envision that child in the hands of God and know that we are all survivors of alcoholism and that she would be okay. And a lot of times I didn't feel that, but I knew that God would protect that baby, and he did. When she was 6 months old, a lot of things started to happen that became so overwhelming to me that I didn't know how I was going to get through the next 4 or 5 years of my life. My son was admitted to the hospital with pneumonia and was very, very sick. And in the process of that recovery, he lost his job. And they were down in Florida living on food stamps, and they were getting diapers from WIC, and they were reaching out to wherever they could to get whatever they needed to get by. And within a few days after I found out that Scott was really ill, my father was diagnosed that his cancer was reoccurring. And I had a 15-year-old German Shepherd dog that was the light of my life. I mean, she was like, when I came home, she was always there for me. And I found out that probably one more shot of cortisone wasn't going to help. And I called my sponsor at that time. And I said to her, this is what's happening in my life. And she said to me, I want you to take that journal that you write in, and I want you to start putting down a miracle a day, because where you have to walk in the next couple of years, you are going to absolutely have to know that God has been there for you. And I took her at that word. I also said, what an order, I can't go through with it, that God doesn't give anybody a miracle a day, and I don't care how hard you look, but I'm here to tell you, he doesn't give you a miracle a day. Every minute that we stand and breathe in and out is a miracle. But there were many, many times in the next 5 years when I would take that journal out and thumb through the pages and find my miracles every day, and know that poem, The Footsteps, when we look behind and see only one set of footsteps, it is not because we have been abandoned, but because we have been carried. And for the next 5 years, I was literally carried by God and the love of this fellowship. My father's cancer did need some radiation and chemotherapy, and he was alone in California. My mom had died many years before, and his lady friend of 8 years died a couple of years before that, and he was literally alone, and he was having to face some chemotherapy and radiation treatments that he needed to be cared for. So we called him up and said, Daddy, come to Texas, and my sister and I will take care of you. And he didn't know how he was going to be able to do that, but it was so simple, just call and make a reservation, get somebody to take you to the airport, and we'll be there to pick you up, and he got there. And he lived with us from August until September or November. It was November he lived with us. And then he and I went back to California and sold his little house and packed up his belongings. And we brought him back to Texas. And by now his health is good enough that we were able to put him in a little apartment. And he got to live alone, he thought. I mean, he really thought he was independent. But see, the gift in that was that my sister and I created an environment for him in which he could keep his dignity. And I don't know how to do that on my own. You taught me about that. You kept telling me day by day what I should do for my father. And what happened, too, is there were days when inside of me I thought, I don't want to drive him for another chemotherapy treatment. I don't want to cook him another meal. I don't want to do it anymore. And you gave me the freedom to say, that's okay. You cannot want to do it, but you got to keep doing it. And because you kept encouraging me to do the things I was getting tired, I kept doing them, and I kept doing them, and I kept loving him, and we kept hugging on him, and we kept kissing him. And then he got sick in January, got a flu bug that was going around, and he had no immune system with the kind of cancer that he had. And he went into the hospital on January 1st, and on February 10th of 1990, my dad passed away. 6 months before he passed away, I ended up having to put the dog to sleep. And I started to walk out of the room when I did that, and there was a little thing inside of me that says, don't turn your back on her now. And so I stood in the vet's office, and I held my dog's head while the vet put her to sleep. And it was the longest 20 seconds of my life. I said, how long does this take? It seemed like forever. And he says, 20 seconds. And I held the dog, and I felt her life leave her. And what I realized out of that was really a privilege to stay there and to stay committed to somebody throughout that experience. And what a loving act it was for both of us to be there. And what it did for me, and I didn't know, the little intuitive thing that says, go back and hold the dog, what I didn't know is that that was preparing me for when I was going to go back and hold my dad. And I held my dad when he died. And I had the same feeling. You know, the other feeling that I have today about my dad is that he was my very best friend, and I loved him dearly, and I think of him, and I miss him terribly, but I don't have any regrets. I'd have never spent a day since my dad passed away that I have once thought I wished it could have been different. I wished I would have done that when he asked me to. So I'm free. But I didn't know how to do that by myself. I wasn't raised in that kind of environment where people taught you how to be available for other people. It was my sponsor. It was my friends in the program. It was the AA people. It was telephone calls. It was cards. It was encouragement. We need each other here. We have got to support each other here. And because I think sometimes God saves some of the hard stuff so we can do it as a group. So anyhow, Scott and Doreen moved back from Florida. And I'm really sorry if I'm sharing with you some tough stuff, but this is my life for the past 5 years. And it has not been an easy journey. And I could brief over it and not tell you about it and possibly not bring up emotion for you. But I need to tell you where I am and what I've walked through and what you've helped me get through, because this is what I'm still in the process. So a year after my father passed away, Scott and Doreen inherited a little bit of my dad's money, and they were able to put together a moving van and get themselves out of Florida and come home, because Scott's health was deteriorating and they wanted to be closer to us in the process. So they got to town, and they parked this little truck in our yard, and we were going to just go out and get an apartment. And George and I would co-sign if it was necessary. And they couldn't find an apartment. She didn't have a job. He was on benefits. I mean, they had nothing. And I mean, who's going to give in Texas? They don't just give you an apartment. So because of the system, they had to live with us for almost a month until George and I ended up having to turn over our will and our life to the care of this development company and actually lease them the apartment for the first year in our name. And we became willing to do that. We were not willing to do that when they got there, but we became willing to do that. And that's what this recovery program is all about, is to become willing to do some things that we say absolutely we will never do. So we signed for that little apartment, and they stayed with us for almost a month. And during that time, see, that was another gift. We grew together. Doreen didn't think she liked me, and Doreen and Scott was definitely sure he didn't like me. And when we were all stuck in this house having to live together, we realized that we really loved each other. And as a result of that, spending that period of time together, my daughter-in-law and I are like mother and daughter. And I, you know, there was a period of time after I had my two boys that I thought I was going to give that one more shot and try for a girl. And there's a lady named Nell who says God's no is but a prelude to a much better yes. And my yes came about 3 years ago when my daughter-in-law and I decided that we really did love each other. And she has been an incredible gift in my life. So the next thing that we got to walk through was the deterioration of Scott's health. And my husband and I did that together. You know, he took Scott to the doctor, and we took care of the baby, and we just all worked as a team to get that through. And Scott was getting more fearful because he was terminally ill. And he was angry. I mean, when you're 28 years old and your diagnosis is not good, you are real angry. He has a little four-year-old girl. He had a lot to look forward to, and he was terminally ill. So we helped him get through that with as much grace and dignity as he could. And we had a program because, see, I have the kind of a feeling inside of me that that anger was about me. And what you taught me was is that anger wasn't about me. It was about his own fears and his own sadness, perhaps about the direction of his life. Because the bottom line is that on February 6th of this year, my son died of alcoholism. And he left us this little child, and he left me a daughter, and he died sober. And it's been really hard to recover from that. But when Scott died, a tear rolled down his cheek, and that scared me. I thought he was so frightened that for the first time there was some fluids, and this tear rolled down his cheek. And later, a few days later, I was to understand that it was a tear of joy. And after I realized that that was a tear of joy, my own recovery from my own grief process started. At Scott's little memorial service, you know, the tough life that he led and the hard way that he used drugs and alcohol, he still had an impression on other people's lives. And at the little memorial service that we had, his friend Stacy stood up and he says, "I have 7 years of sobriety thanks to Scott." His brother stood up and he says, "I have 12 years of sobriety thanks to Scott." And his dad stood up and he says, "I have 12 years of sobriety thanks to Scott." And my brother-in-law stood up and he says, "I have 11 years of sobriety thanks to Scott." And I realized that even though Scott couldn't stay sober for himself, the influence of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous came to us from him. And through him, there were a lot of people who were living lives that Scott himself probably wanted, but he had a disease that wouldn't let him get better. And I made a new dedication to my program at that time, and I realized that I could not become complacent. That Scott gave me this program of recovery so that I would be able to live happy, joyous, and free. And I have, and I enjoy doing that. I love my home group. The same sponsor who told me to write in a journal also told me to be committed to a home group, and it's not for me. It's so that if a newcomer comes into the room and sees me there on a regular basis, that there might be something about me that encourages me to come back. And I remembered that for myself. When I was new in the program, there was a lady there. She had pretty blonde hair, and she wore bright colors, and she always had a smile. And every time I'd walk into that Al-Anon room, if she was sitting there, I knew I was going to be okay. And my sponsor pointed out that there are people, now that I'm getting some time in the program, and I'm starting to learn to live this spiritual life, that there are people who are watching me. And I don't go to those meetings for me anymore. I go to them so that I can be there, so that a newcomer will walk in and say, "I'm going to be okay today because Beverly's there." And you know, that's a wonderful gift that I have, a feeling of commitment to something. So I'm committed to two separate home groups because I live far away from Dallas. So I drive into Dallas one day, and I have a little home group just a mile from my house. And we're a strong little group. We're going to celebrate our first Al-Anon, our first birthday in our little group. We meet in a church. It has babysitting, which is great because I take care of this little baby right now. Or she's not a little baby. She's 45 going on 5. And she's going to start kindergarten in the middle of August, and she's absolutely a delight. But see, God even prepared that for me because my two home groups had babysitters. And so I've had this little girl. George goes down to Carrollton and picks her up at 6:30 in the morning. And she comes into my bedroom at 6:30 in the morning, and she is wearing a little flowered hat, and we scratch backs. And I know that I have recovered because I can treat this little girl with more love than I was ever able to give my own children. So what the gift in that is that God's given me a second chance. And there's been a lot of other gifts through this, what the book said today about relieving us of some of our denials so we can go on and give our best. I've been removed. A lot of fear has been removed from me. I don't find it necessary to scream and yell at my children or my husband as often anymore. Sometimes we are all out of control. But, you know, I can give myself permission to just be human today and know that I'm recovering from this disease. And I know today I woke up about 2 or 3 weeks ago and I realized that all of that black tunnel that I was so afraid to go through it was gone. And I was standing in the light, and for the first time in a long time, that I could just enjoy my life, that I didn't have anything impossible to try to get through. And so I have, for the past 4 weeks, decided that each day truly is a new beginning for me. And you've showed me how to say yes to life and to go where I'm asked to go and to do what I want to do and not to say no to things and adventures. And for that, I am extremely grateful. I want to thank all of you for your prayers, because I know that they supported us. And I would like to thank all of you for inviting me to come here this morning, and all of you that were willing to get up early and have breakfast and come to the Al-Anon meeting. I appreciate that. And I can feel your love, and I can see the sparkle in your eyes. And I just am so grateful to be a part of this convention, and so grateful to be a recovering member of the Al-Anon family group. Thank you.